What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Smoking Tire Podcast. This episode of the Smoking Tire is brought to you by Vivid Seats. You know, we all love a night out, whether it's seeing our favorite band in person, going to a race, or being there in the crowd to cheer on our favorite team. With Vivid Seats, you can attend the concert, show, race, or sporting event of your choice at a great price. Vivid Seats is the top source for tickets for all the live events you want to go to. You can sort by price or look for seats in the section or row of your choice. To make things even better, Vivid Seats is giving listeners an exclusive promo code for new customers to receive 10% off your first purchase with Vivid Seats to save them even more money. Go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. Use promo code TIRE for 10% off your first purchase with Vivid Seats. Every purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee. From the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more, Vivid Seats has it all. Download the app and enter promo code TIRE for 10% off your first purchase with Vivid Seats. Make a memory that lasts a lifetime and let Vivid Seats help you get to your favorite live event. That's 10% off with code TIRE when you download the Vivid Seats app. We are also brought to you by Continental Belts. When you're under the hood, you ever notice how often you see Continental Belts? There is a reason for that. Continental is one of the world's largest original equipment suppliers for the automotive industry. Automakers around the world insist on Continental for original equipment belts. The U.S., all the big three, BMW, Volkswagen, over 30% of all new vehicles sold in North America. You know what that says? It says Continental knows original equipment because they are original equipment. Continental's OE Technology Series multi-V belts for the automotive aftermarket are precision engineered for perfect fit, form, and function with a true OE pedigree. They're the belts engines already know. So you can confidently spec Continental's multi-V belts. There's one for 98% of the vehicles on the road today. You might not know it, but Continental is also a leader in automotive technology, electronic components for things like autonomous driving and accident-free zones. That focus on innovation is in every product they make, including the OE Technology Series aftermarket belts. Check them out. Just check them out. That's all we're asking. Just check them out. And lastly, we're brought to you by Rad Power Bikes. This is a consumer direct electric bike company producing five unique models of electric bicycles. Because Rad Power Bikes is a consumer direct brand, buyers get a premium electric bike without paying the huge markups caused by dealers and third-party retailers, priced at often less than half of the price of comparable bikes on the market, because dealer and retail markups are completely cut out. On top of their already awesome price, this coming Cyber Monday, which is November 26th, Rad Power Bikes is making it even easier to get people riding. There are deals on all models of electric bikes with up to $400 off per model. One day only sale on Cyber Monday. Cyber Monday also includes free shipping on all electric bikes to the lower 48 states. Save you some extra cash there. At 750 watts of power, all five models have the most powerful motor an e-bike can have, while maintaining a street legal status. No license, registration, or insurance required. You can finance your bike for as low as 0% APR. Just about $100 a month can get you riding. All five models will reach 20 miles an hour with zero pedaling. All five models give riders the choice to ride pedal 3 with the throttle, utilize five levels of pedal assist for added boost, or any combination of the two. You can travel between 20 and 40 miles on a single charge. I've ridden these things. They are really fun. You can go quite a bit faster than you can go on a normal bike, and you can use them as fully under power, so you can get to work or whatever without being all sweaty from pedaling. Visit radpowerbikes.com/podcast. That's radpowerbikes.com/podcast to learn more, and don't forget to shop their Cyber Monday sale on November 26th to save big.
Okay, on this episode of the podcast, I interview Michael Dweck. Michael is the director, producer, writer of the new documentary, The Last Race, which focuses on a period of time covering Long Island's last oval track. And right now you're probably going, Long Island has an oval track? Yeah, they do. In fact, they used to have a lot more of them. This one, Riverhead Raceway, is the last one left. The owners are aging, but very committed, and the cast of characters that can be found there every weekend when they race is unbelievable. It's a great interview. Michael Dweck on the Smoking Tire Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Smoking Tire Podcast. I'm flying solo today. Zach has a gig, but I'm here in Studio A with Mr. Michael Dweck, the director, producer, writer, kind of one man show sort of deal of the last race.
Well, I had a you know, a cinematographer with me too. So
was it literally? Is it a crew of two? Was
it that much? Small? Crew of two, and some sound guy thrown in it once in a while.
Oh man! So yeah. you kind of work on the budgets that we work on. We're in the same. We're playing in the same field.
Pretty much.
The
I call it intimate filmmaking.
Yeah. Right. The film, The Last Race, seems real cool. I have not gotten to check it out yet, but I did watch the trailer, and I can relate to all of these sort of concepts, the encroaching corporate sprawl on the small business and the racetracks getting shut down and the mean people. It's like Caddyshack, mean people in suits taking over, you know, Bushwood.
I call it galloping rot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this film sort of starts around the fact that there were once many racetracks in Long Island.
That's right.
Is that where you're from?
I am. I'm from a town called Belmore, Long Island.
Oh, yeah.
And I was raised next to a racetrack, which was in Freeport. The first racetrack ever in the country.
Was in Freeport?
Freeport, 1927.
Wait a minute. Not the first racetrack in the country.
Ever in the country.
Well, but ever. Here in Los Angeles, we had racetracks before that.
Before 1927?
No way. The Los Angeles the Santa Monica Grand Prix ran from 1908 to 1912.
Is that a racetrack, though?
Well, they used a street circuit.
That's different.
They had board tracks here.
Yeah. Well, there was actually another. Well, there was a race circuit in Long Island. It was a Vanderbilt Cup that ran from 1908 to 1911.
Okay.
And that was Cornelius Vanderbilt trying to promote racing in general, the auto industry in general.
Yeah.
So that might have been around the same time. But a formal race track, an actual
like with
oval.
Asphalt and
yeah.
Okay.
Well, dirt. Well, it was dirt at the time. But a dirt track, a quarter mile dirt track, the first one, 1927.
And that, which was that racetrack?
Freeport Stadium. There was a boxing ring in the middle.
Uh-huh.
There was a running track beyond that. In the middle of it was a soccer field, and on the outside was a racetrack.
Oh, wow, they really layered this thing deep, didn't they?
They did.
It was a multi-purpose facility.
Well, that's all there was to do in the town. I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
Boxing has a lot to do with racing, I have to say, so that was a good idea.
Boxing has a lot to do with racing? Were you being sarcastic? Or
no, it's kind of true. Well, I would say bullfighting, but boxing is pretty close. Well, because you're, it's violent. It's interesting. There's an underdog. There's a protagonist, an antagonist. I mean, it's very, very similar.
Mm.
And so that's.
Did you grow up going to races there?
I did, twice a week. Tuesday,
really?
Tuesday and Saturday, I'd never missed a race unless it was raining. But that's where I was from 4 years old till 18. I was at Freeport Stadium until they knocked it down and put a BJ's Wholesale.
How exciting! That's the story. That's the story of like every racetrack, right? They knocked it down and put a Costco or put a mall or put a
always. Yeah, there were 40. I mean, the first part of the film, the first moment of the film, is that where Charles Lindbergh took off from. They paved that over and built the first shopping mall, the first interior shopping mall, Roosevelt Field. Where that was from.
God,
so that
tells a lot about. I hate Roosevelt Field.
It's horrible.
I'm from New York as well, so I'm familiar with some of these places.
Are you a Long Island boy?
No, I'm a Westchester boy.
Okay.
I grew up in Rye.
So Rye is Rye Playland.
Still standing.
Still
yes.
There.
For those who don't know what that is, it's a fairly terrible amusement park, but probably best known for the sight of the Zoltar machine in the movie Big.
That's
Yeah. But actually, they had the Dragon Coaster, which was a pretty well-known roller coaster.
Right.
And it's one of the oldest, I think, 1922, 24 maybe, they built that thing.
Right on the water.
Incredibly sketchy.
Yeah,
when you're a kid, that thing is real sketchy, that roller coaster.
But sketchy is good. Sketchy is thrilling. Makes you feel alive.
It does.
Like
when you're young, it's the G-forces and all those things of roller coasters. When you're older and you realize it's not that big, it's the sketchiness is really from the age of the wood, and the look on the kid's face who's running the thing.
And the parents crying.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Call people died on that roller coaster.
Oh, that's what makes
it
fun.
They stand up, and that's the end.
Well,
that's the game over.
That makes it fun. I mean, just like in the movie. Well, you have to see the movie, but in the movie, you see there's a scene where a guy's almost completely engulfed in flames.
That's in the trailer as well. It's pretty brutal.
It's pretty brutal. 65% of his body completely burned.
Oh, there it is right there on the screen. It's in your rotating.
Jimmy White Jr.
Yeah. What's his name?
Jimmy White Jr.
What a racing name.
Whew. Jimmy White Jr. A lot of juniors and seniors in the film, but he's a guy. So burned 65% of his body in the hospital for 2 months, gets out of the hospital that first Saturday, racing a racetrack again.
That's crazy.
And that's normal.
Are you a race fan, a lifelong race fan, or is it more of a story about, you know, your town and or in your area than about racing?
Yeah, I'd say it's more of a story about communities. All my work, my photography work, and my this film and my next film are all about communities on the edge of extinction, and that's something I'm very concerned about. It's about losing communities to commercialization.
Yeah, you read the Amazon thing today?
I did.
That's what they need, $1.5 billion to move to New York.
We need that.
That's really draw them to
New York hasn't changed enough lately. We have the population of New York's increased 1 million over the last 10 years.
That's crazy. I grew up in Atlanta where it went from, 2 million to 8 million or something.
Well,
you know,
New York is moving down there.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Why.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So where did all these racetracks just get mowed over and didn't go on?
It's pretty easy to mow them over. They're just asphalt. I mean, when I started to shoot, I was shooting photography at that racetrack at Riverhead for 5 years, in 2007 to 2012. And what started as 100% dense forest and farmland, it's the cauliflower capital of the world, it says on the sign as you enter Riverhead. By the time I had finished photography in 2012, almost all the trees were down and all the farmland was gone. And that's why I decided to spend time memorializing the track before it was gone. And then the 5 years that ensued from 2012 to 2017, what I saw was across the street, there was one little patch of trees left that was mowed down and built a 200,000 square foot Costco across from the racetrack, right across. Next to the racetrack, they illegally stripped down 14 acres of trees and put a shop, 100,000 square foot Christmas tree store, right up to the edge of the racetrack, to the fence of the racetrack is the asphalt. And then on that same street, there's two Walmarts. One Walmart wasn't enough, so they built a super Walmart. So this little tiny town was decimated in a matter of 5 years.
That is sad, but kind of inevitable. You know,
well,
is it?
if you don't understand the importance of things like this in your community, because, take this racetrack. You know, what it's about is working class people that have, really tough jobs during the week. They go home, they work on their race cars every single night, straight through the winter, for the chance to, on a Saturday night, to win basically a $7 trophy. But what they get more than that is that they get dignity.
Yeah.
They get a
lot of glory
people.
In that $7 trophy.
2,000 people cheering your name. You get announced by the announcer.
Yeah, you're a guy who's like a plumber during the week,
right.
And then you're a rock star, when you get there.
And I know how that goes. What's the value of that?
I've stood on a podium a couple times. It is riveting.
Feels great.
Even when there's like 2 dozen people there, it still feels awesome.
It feels great.
Yeah.
And then you have fans that come in the pits after the race, get your autograph. Imagine you're getting a plumber giving an autograph.
Yeah.
But you put on the suit.
You put on the suit, you get in the car with the stickers on it.
And
you
change, but you transform. I watch even the owners, 87 years old, through the filming, they both had strokes. They both broke their hips. Every Friday, they put on their NASCAR uniforms, drive from New York City to Riverhead, 60 miles. They sleep at a Holiday Inn, next morning get up 8 o'clock, open the beer stand, that's from the 40s, with a block of ice. Open the hot dog stand, open the ticket booth, open the gates to the pits, and like Barbara says in the film, most of our friends that retired die.
Yeah.
And we have youth. And they mean it because I watch them transform. Them and all the drivers, they go from old people, 87-year-old, to kids when they're at that racetrack. It's a very beautiful thing to watch.
Is it... But you said multi-generational. So are there kids and grandkids there to pick up behind them?
There are. You have, not behind Barbara and Jim. Barbara and Jim, they have three daughters. None of them want to get into the racing game.
Are they itching to sell?
Well, it's worth $10 million, the last piece of land left in that town, undeveloped. So even when I was filming that, there was always a knock on the trailer door on Saturdays. A developer would always come by saying, hey, hi, Bob or Jim. I want to buy the racetrack, and they just say, get out.
Yeah,
not interested.
The same developer or new developers every time?
No, all different developers. The guy next door, of course, was the most aggressive. He's in the film golfing.
The one on the golf course, yes.
Yeah, Marty Berger. He's great. Yeah, he said, I just want to expand. I want to take my mall. I just want to expand it to where you are. And he said, I'm very patient.
It's so weird because malls are dying too.
Malls are dying. Well, that's what you're going to have left. You're going to have left just these.
You're just going to have carcasses of malls, right?
Yeah,
who's building fucking malls right now? Like, what are you doing with
more greedy developers?
Yeah.
You know, but you realize once these things are gone, once, you know, it's not just only about racetracks, but once you have places like this where the community can gather, not here anymore, then what do you have left? What do they do? Well, they stay at Walmart every day and just, I don't know, shop and get home and play video games. Here, you know, you're building a race car. You have a father teaching a son how to build a car. And at 13 years old, you're legally allowed to race a race car on any racetrack in this country. At 13, you can't get a driver's license.
No, I know.
Or a permit, but you can race at 100 miles an hour.
Out here, do you live out here now, or do you live
back York, east? I come out here quite a bit.
So out here, you know, we have a lot of kids who race. I mean, a lot. It's really, you know, especially because we have a lot of wealthy parents that can enable that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I know a kid who does not have a driver's license who was racing Lamborghinis. Yeah. I mean, forget, you know, beater old Chevys, you know, in Riverhead. I'm talking about racing Lambos in Vegas at Willow Springs, for real, and that's, you know, it's not, I don't want to say that that's a common story, but that happens. Yeah. That happens a bunch. I had just sitting in that chair last night, a gentleman named Ryan Finney who races IndyCar, mm-hmm. and he was driving cars at 14 and 15, proper race cars before he had a driver's license.
You betcha.
Yeah.
Where else can you do that? That's a lot of fun.
Well, California is a good place to do it, for sure.
I mean, you can race go-karts at 70 miles an hour at 7 years old.
Yeah. And they do.
Encouraging that.
And they do, and they should. It's awesome.
They should. They should.
Are you into cars at all?
I am.
You are? Mm-hmm. What do you drive?
Cars.
What do you drive?
Well, believe it or not, now in New York, I don't drive a car.
Yeah, so.
But I used to restore cars all the time.
Oh, yeah?
English cars.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Glutton for punishment.
Yeah. Those SU carburetors. But I used to, I restored everything from, my first car was an MG.
Okay.
MGB 76. Then I restored Austin Healey's, then old Jag, SK 120s, 140s.
And gradually moving up in values, yeah.
Well, I started it. My father gave me $20 to buy a car, so I went, bought a junker, and then started restoring them, keep buying. I want a nicer car, go build one.
Yeah. So did you ever race?
I did.
Mm-hmm. What'd you race?
I raced Formula Fords.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, for a little while until I ran out of money, which was pretty quick.
An expensive hobby.
That's a hobby. I raced in Bridgehampton.
Oh, yeah. We hear a lot
which is now a golf course.
I hear a lot about Bridgehampton. Right, perfect example.
It's a great golf course. Yeah, why not?
Here in L.A., we had so many racetracks as well. I mean, we had Beverly Hills. There was a racetrack in Beverly Hills, Santa Monica. I mean, the very famous Riverside that everyone talks about all the time. Paramount, mm-hmm. which just burned to the ground.
Yeah, that's right.
Was the first place that Carroll Shelby ever raced a car.
Wow, really?
Was up in Malibu. Yeah, Paramount Ranch Raceway.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was an amazing place.
But they're important to towns. I mean, the communities come together like a church.
But you ever find that they're important to towns, and yet they're always fighting with the towns?
Well, towns don't like them because they're noisy, but look at it, they were there first.
You
strip all the trees down and you stop building condos, that's what happens. It gets noisy.
Totally. And I'm sure you're familiar with Laguna Seca.
You betcha.
Laguna Seca was there first. Neighbors move in, they start bitching about the sound, and now it's heavily sound restricted.
Yeah.
And we hear this over and over where the racetrack is there first. The neighbors move in, and the neighbors start complaining, and now the racetrack's got to comply with it.
It's a beautiful sound, though.
It is a beautiful sound.
They should just learn to appreciate it.
It's got a great carry, you know?
It does.
The ovals, it's kind of sort of contained, you know? The road courses, well, the banking kind of keeps it in a little bit.
Yeah, but they don't know what they're missing.
I know.
I mean, if they experience it once, that's what I'm hoping with the film, because I welded 20 cameras onto these race cars on purpose,
mm-hmm.
so that, and I lost a lot of them, of course, but I welded a camera.
Do you
camera.
Have a camera graveyard sort of on your wall?
Yeah, we do. They're melted, you know, lenses that are melted into two.
Yeah.
But what I did was I wanted people that weren't familiar with racing to understand what it felt like, not to necessarily be an audience member, but what it felt like to be a car. And what I feel like to be a driver. So by doing that, well, I weld cameras onto bumpers and fenders. And this type of racing, you're allowed to make contact.
Yeah, they don't even care. There's a lot of rubbing.
A lot of rubbing.
Because this is, you know, you talk about stock cars in the sense of NASCAR. Mm-hmm. Those are not stock cars. No. Those are tube frame cars that have headlight stickers and whatever. Like at Riverhead, these are stock cars. These are like Caprices and Crown Vics and Monte Carlos and stuff.
Those are the three cars, the most popular cars you name right there.
Yeah, Caprice, Crown Vic, Monte Carlo, right?
Mm-hmm. 4,200 pounds you have to weigh.
Yeah. Minimum, right?
Minimum.
Is a minimum 4,200 pounds.
That's a big ass.
Is that a quarter mile oval?
Quarter of a mile.
Yeah.
30 cars.
That's crazy.
100 miles an hour, quarter mile oval.
Do they even put big motors in them? They literally run them stock, don't they?
Well, they're stock, but they're big block. They're eights.
Yeah, but like they don't put like big crazy race motors in them, right?
They're
basically like. They're one step removed from demo derby cars, pretty much.
Pretty much. I mean, when somebody gets taken into a wall, you know.
Well, they're caged up. You know, they're caged up, but
they're dangerous. They're not like, I think these are a lot more dangerous than NASCAR cars. These guys are crazy.
Sure.
These guys are nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is cool. That's what makes it the same. The cars haven't changed since 1970.
Yeah, they really haven't.
Or the people.
Yeah. Did you see a lot of, in the trailer at least, it implies that there's quite a bit of fighting that goes on the race in the
It's about settling up.
Yeah.
Well, you take somebody into a wall. It's not an accident. They're good. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You spin a guy, you're going to pay for it in the pits.
Yeah.
And then the next day, you're all friends. You need a carburetor, crankshaft. They're there for you. It's very unusual.
So crazy what happens when you get into a race car. And then when you get out of it and you take what happened on the track kind of with you. You know,
it's
dangerous. I mean, you could, you know, if your ego, you know, overtakes your brain, you know, you could cause someone some serious injury.
Yeah, you can. It's a 4,000 pound chunk of metal.
Yeah. How long did you follow the track and was it a whole season of racing?
No. Well, it looks like a whole season, but I followed it I filmed for 2.5 years at the track.
Oh, wow.
And I photographed for 5 years before that.
That's some chronicle.
It's a lot of hearing loss.
What's one of the more, you know, with that much footage, obviously some great stuff didn't make the final cut. What's some of the better stuff that didn't get to make it into the movie?
Well, it's funny you mention that because tomorrow night there's going to be a sneak peek all over the country in 100 markets, 100 theaters.
That's awesome.
And it's going to be at Regal Theaters, and I'm showing 5 scenes of the film that didn't make it. That I really love, my director's cut. That's a one night only thing. And there's also Kyle Busch did a great interview because he comes from his own little bull ring in Las Vegas, short track racing.
Uh-huh.
And he loved the film, and he gave a really beautiful interview just about short track and his life and how he eventually became hopefully this year's champion. But he's a, you know, great cup racer. So what didn't make it in was there's one scene where it's a little argument ensued. Somebody take somebody into a wall, and you get into the pits, and there's a little discussion that goes on. It's a loud discussion. A lot of stuff flies.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of stuff flies. That's one scene. I mean, it's about, you know, it's 10 guys kind of settling up in the pits, but you see the slow build into exactly what happened. And then there's also a beautiful scene of a marching band that just, the marching band comes onto the track on 4th of July. It's a beautiful band, all composed of everybody from the town. Picks up an instrument, whether they can play or not, and they are the opening ceremony for 4th of July. And I just had the camera set really in between them as they kind of went through. It's like a one-shot scene of this beautiful choreography of this marching band of just, you know, people, local people, regular people from the town with instruments that aren't necessarily tuned up perfectly.
Yeah.
But a beautiful scene. There's also another scene with Pastor Scott, who he wears a fire suit since Racing for Jesus. And he prays with all the drivers.
Jesus would love NASCAR.
Yeah,
he was
a racer back then. Yeah. He prays the drivers, every single driver, before they go onto the track. And he's in the film. You see, is a sermon he gives, and his sermons are all about racing. Every sermon. So the race.
Does he have like a normal church? Is it only the race? Does he only preach at the track?
No, he preaches at the church, but he preaches at the church only about racing. That's it.
I could get down on that.
Yeah. So he's cool. So he's the race doesn't start until he does donuts on the track in a Comet.
I mean, for the Lord.
Yeah, racing with Jesus. Yeah. That's a scene you're going to see that didn't make it to the film because it just didn't fit.
Yeah.
I could have made it. My first cut of the film was 3 hours.
Yeah, that's a long one.
That was a long one.
But is it you get attached to certain scenes? It's hard to
all the scenes. Yeah,
to cut stuff down. You know, it's like you want there to be a 3 hour cut because it's probably good.
Yeah. Well, I shot 360 hours.
That's a lot.
And then the editor said to me, "Okay, this is what I want you to do. I want you to pick out every scene you must have in the film.
Yeah.
Hang it on the wall." And then I'm going to come in 3 hours and see what you put on the wall. So I you know, have frames of every scene. I had 1,260 scenes. And she came in and said, "I'm not working on this project.
We're going to have to cut this down by two thirds."
Yeah. But this film is very unique in that it doesn't have a typical storyline. It doesn't have a typical antagonist protagonist. It does have a three act structure to it, but it doesn't have main characters. My main character happens to be
the racetrack. Yeah,
I don't have a human character, so the challenge was in editing this film is juxtaposing moments. Mm. I'm just immersing you into a place. It's a new way of filmmaking. I immerse you into this place and let you observe. There's not a lot of editing. Every scene is uncut. It's just you watch an announcer 6 minutes. Taking you through a race because I want you to just observe how incredibly amazing this man is in his memory and what he's doing by announcing sponsors, the audience. I mean, he knows a lot and he's been doing that since he was
18
years old.
There's really something to be said. Like, I've done some announcing and stuff, and the people who know every driver personally and know everything about it. I mean, it's like it can't come from like memorizing a sheet. You know, you have to have been there for a long, long time.
And he's been sitting in that chair from 18 to 76. This guy's been sitting in that same chair.
From 18 years old to 76 years old? Jesus.
Yeah.
Does it seem like what are the owners' names again?
Barbara and Jim Cromedy.
Does it seem that they've got a lot of patience left for this, or are they running out of steam?
I think that it's waning. I think it's really difficult for them, especially their injuries. If you look at the last, in the film, you'll see I track their health through the film, and it it's hard. They, you have a couple 87-year-olds that had both had strokes, and both broken their hips and can't take care of one another anymore. That's very difficult. And you're still keeping us alive, and they're keeping it alive not for the money, by the way. They're keeping it alive because they feel responsible to the community.
Is there an option for, their kids aren't into it, the developers are creeping in. Is there another option for the community to raise the money and take over the track themselves? Is that
that's
a possibility?
Well, the town, of course, doesn't want the track anymore.
Right.
They did want the track, but now the new administration doesn't want the track, and they're pro-development. So that's not a positive thing. The hope is that they find somebody that they'll say, we'll sell it to somebody as long as they promise to keep it open as a racetrack. Otherwise, we're not selling it. And they're going they're not giving up.
Yeah.
So it's a really beautiful story about inspiration, perseverance. I mean, they against all odds. I mean, I was with Barbara in the hospital. She had suffered a stroke and I'm visiting her and I said, so is this, why are you going to continue this? Your kids, I've talked to them. They said, just get out. It's just not healthy for you anymore. And she just said, shut up. Get out of here. I don't want to hear that negative thought. And I'll see you at the racetrack on Saturday. And you know what? She did.
That's amazing.
They just don't give up.
That's amazing.
But they feel, it's important to the town. I mean, it's I think at first they were in it just as a business. They were just going to, they've been in the, they had a hockey team before. They had roller derby. They had all these little, they had flea markets before, and this was supposed to be a 2-year, in and out business, but ended up doing it for 30 years or 37 years. And they put on their NASCAR uniforms, and they feel like they're one of the guys. I mean, they're just the racer.
Yeah.
Like she says in the film, I never raced a car before, but I know what it's like. And then she gets, the first time I saw her really get emotional is when she started to talk about what it's like for the racing and the family. And she said, she started to cry, and she said, I don't know where you get a feeling like this, where somebody, a regular person, a mechanic, has a shoe store, gets into a car and races and feels alive again. I don't know where you get that, and that's a very beautiful thing. I mean, what else can you experience like that, where all four senses are going? Nothing.
I mean, to me, I really love racing cars. I think it's
But
you get to shut off the world.
Yeah.
The smells of race gas and
the
rubber
smell, the
and
sight,
all this.
The hearing. Where can you get all that? Where can you get all that visceral experience.
And it's legal.
Yeah.
Barely.
Barely.
Yeah. I mean, you'll never open a new, they'll never build a new racetrack ever.
That, unless they're private. I mean, the new racetracks they build
in a desert,
are private, and they're in the desert or in the middle of the woods, usually the desert. I mean, here in California, they opened a new one not long ago outside of Palm Springs, Thermal Club.
Yeah, in the desert.
Private.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know,
private.
Big, you know, membership. It's like, yeah, you got to buy a $2 million house, then you can have it, then you can go.
Yeah. But for the regular, you know, where it started.
They're not opening ovals. Monkeys. Nobody, I mean, they're not. They're opening road courses for rich guys. Yeah. They're not opening ovals for locals.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as an oval in this country that's less than 50 years old.
That's a shame. We'll have to hope with the movie that once people see it, especially non-racing people see it, they'll understand the importance of these in your town. There's 231 left, I think.
Is that what it is? Ovals. 231?
But there used to be 3,600.
There's one up at called Glen Helen up here.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know that one?
Oh yeah, it's a famous track.
Yeah, and Glen Helen gets on their, you know, whatever their Saturday night, you know, races are, late modified or whatever they call them, gets 15,000 spectators.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's crazy.
That's great. A little but that's great.
A little half mile.
Yeah, but those modifieds go pretty fast.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
and they're loud, and they're cool.
And the sprint cars are amazing too. There's some scary shit.
Scary shit. They accelerate. They're pretty cool.
It's like 600 horsepower, no gears, direct drive, just, and then you're straddling like, you know, a transmission basically.
Yeah,
it goes right between your legs. Those guys. It's nuts.
It's great, but you know. But what happens when those things disappear? And what do you do?
I don't know. It's you like what happens games. To what happens to like all the cars from the 30s and 40s, like that aren't, you know, there's like your cars that are like $1 million, you know, and then will be in museums now. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, who's going to buy like a 46 Dodge?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like nobody gives a shit about that stuff anymore.
They turn it to scrap.
Yeah.
So if it's you can make more bridges in China.
Right.
All the infrastructure was from here was from scrap metal.
All the junkyards here, the drivers always talk about how hard it is to find parts for their cars from the 70s because it was all sold for scrap.
Not surprised.
They went overseas. Yeah.
Is there a secondary economy? They make that stuff?
Where? Over there?
I don't know. Somewhere?
They just make bridges.
Yeah, I was down in New Zealand and like, you know, every car club, it's like, okay, you can weld and you can cast aluminum and you can do body work. And they pass all their shit around, you know? So there's one guy who covers everything, you know, and then they end up having like, you know, one guy for each thing. They manage to get stuff done that way.
That's good.
What are some of the other more interesting folks that can be found around Riverhead? And you mentioned the announcer and of course the owners.
Bob Finan's great. Well, you have Captain Video, who's the track videographer.
Okay.
He's been doing it for 29 years now. He's a volunteer, like most of the people are. And what he does is he has an old video camera that he takes very seriously, and he films the race.
How old are we talking? Like Super 8 old? Or?
Oh, yeah. Oh, pretty good. No, he's a first generation VHS camera.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but he don't think it's a problem. So he films the race, and if you win, he records your speech, and then he comes back the next week and sells you a DVD for $1. But it takes him.
He could probably raise his prices.
Well, that's the thing. Well, he's at home. You watch him. He labors. It takes him like 3 hours to edit this thing, by the way. He has the whole race. He puts in he has a cable attached to the announcer sound feed, and he makes this beautiful DVD for $1. But that's his value of the track. That gives him purpose in life, because during the week, he's a postal carrier.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, it's not a great job. But then on the weekend, he's Captain Video, wears a uniform. He has a booth
up
there. Is
there like a cape?
Like, no, I want to make him a cape. He wears mostly Hawaiian shirts. I don't know why, but
that works for Captain Video. Yeah, actually, I think.
Yeah, but he's always at the front line. He hops over the fence as soon as a race is won. He gets your speech. He tells you to smile every time, and then he goes in the pits. He's in the film. You see, he goes in the pits round and just delivers your DVDs. He's a really beautiful character. I like him a lot, and of course, you know, I like Pastor Scott. I think is gold.
Have the folks in the movie seen it yet?
They have. They went to see it. We screened it in Hampton Film Festival a couple of weeks ago, which is only 10 miles from the racetrack.
Yeah.
But very different kind of community.
I'm sure the people in the Hamptons really were happy to see the Riverhead Raceway folks at the screen.
Let me describe this scene for you. So it is outside the West Hampton movie theater. There was about 400 people waiting outside, and the festival manager at that location came up to me and said, "Look, we don't want any trouble here." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "We don't want any trouble here." I said, "I heard you, but what's the problem?" He said, "That crowd outside." So he called security for us, and we really were.
It's like, they all have tickets, man.
Yeah,
chill.
I know. And it was great. I thought they really loved the film. They were cheering and screaming, and it was cool. I think they liked seeing themselves on screen and realize.
I'm sure they do. I mean, if they feel like a rock star on a podium, you know, now they're immortalized.
On a big,
you know?
It was a big screen. It was like an 80-foot screen they were looking at themselves
on. Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, and I gave everybody a credit. I said, if you stay to the end, you'll see every single person in this entire track has a credit in this film.
I bet the IMDb folks love that.
Oof, I think I have the longest end credits in the history of filmmaking. I think it's 10% of the film, pretty much. It just keeps going.
That's awesome. Yeah. So now that you've made a film about this, what's the next film?
I'm working on a film right now. I just got back from Italy 2 days ago. I'm working on a film called The Hunt, which is about very similar to this in that, well, it's about truffle hunters.
That's cool.
Community of truffle hunters. They're 80 to 90 years old. The last generation of truffle hunters in northern Italy.
Let me guess, their kids aren't super into truffle hunting.
Just don't want to hike in the mud at midnight for 8 hours a night with a dog and no light. It just doesn't seem to be attractive to it. But it's a beautiful, it's another community on the edge of extinction. And, you know, it's about passion. They're out there every single night. Imagine your grandfather, 85 years old, walking 20 miles a night in the mountains.
In the dark.
In the damp mountains, in the dark with no lights. With a little white dog looking for a fungus attached to an oak tree root.
That's but if you exactly took that away from that 85-year-old guy, that's you right. know what I mean? You couldn't even take it away from
that's
him.
Right.
That's his purpose in life, right?
That's his.
But there's
that's
no
his race
one.
Car.
There's nobody to take over for them. That's it.
Not really. I mean, we're learning.
What are us
is
truffle
that,
eaters going to do?
I know all of us. I know.
You know, I'm not joking. I'm serious. I love a truffle.
And this is a white truffle too.
This is the good shit.
You cannot cultivate these.
They have
hard to find.
There's a restaurant down here that's got them, and you can add them.
Now you can get this month. This is the month.
Yeah, you can add them to any. It's like this restaurant Giorgio Baldi that I love. It's like one of the best Italian restaurants in Los Angeles. You can get them added to any dish.
Wow.
But it's like. By gram. $150 gram or something.
It's like hunting for gold.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. Like, oh, here's a bowl of pasta. It's like $24. That's an expensive bowl of pasta, but we can make it a $200 bowl. You just say the word, you know.
Slice away. It's another beautiful community. They're I've been filming there. I filmed there for 3 months last fall because it's seasonal, and then I went back about 4 weeks ago, filmed for 3.5 weeks straight. And then I'm going back November 26th to film for another 4 weeks. And we'll wrap up. It'll be done by next fall.
So this is going to be your genre is filming communities on the verge of extinction?
You betcha.
It's a good genre, actually.
I think so. And it's also it's about immersion. I'm going to, you know, this film is similar to The Last Race in that it's going to be very cinematic. Mm. So I take my time with the shot. We shoot one scene a day. So they're beautiful scenes, and I'm going to immerse you in this story visually instead of with words. I'm not going to give you a history lesson like The Last Race. I don't have an announcer telling you about the history of the racetrack, history of racing. I just let you figure it out for yourself.
Well, that's guys walking in the woods for truffles.
He is.
Just like they've been doing for hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years is right. Yeah. And it's just like hunting for gold. And then what's beautiful is they sell them in the black market. It's the only way you can sell them. They go out 4 a.m. And it's like a drug deal. They're on they're right behind it. The shadows of a church.
You got the stuff?
Huh?
You got the stuff?
That's what they do. Imagine you got
the cash?
Dude,
you got the lira?
Yeah, that's right.
Were they about you filming the shady part?
They're cool. No, I've tried. I cannot. The deal of the truffle, they won't let me. Every time
no?
I show up with a camera, they think I work for the government.
That's so funny.
The tax department. Is it really? Do I really look like a tax guy?
I can't
speak the language.
In Italy, the taxes can be a little...
Well, that's the problem.
You know?
They don't want to pay the taxes there.
I was on a family vacation in Italy, and we had a day trip from Naples to Positano on a lovely little 45-foot boat with a captain. It was great,
that's
right?
A beautiful trip.
They drop us off at the restaurant, you know, mm-hmm. at the beach, and the boat's on anchor, just mm-hmm. sitting out there. The police roll up and oh. seize the boat.
Oh, hello.
We're just stuck Whoa. There. We watch them. The owner of the boat wow. didn't pay taxes, and they seized wow. the boat.
Oh, man.
We're, I mean, vacation not over that, that not that yeah. Positano is a bad place wow. to be stranded, but we had to wait a while for them to send another boat.
Well, that's a yeah, that's a problem. Well, people, that's a lot of people don't pay taxes.
They just kind of don't. They protest yeah. the government by not paying their taxes.
Yeah, like so what they did, I think they paid 20% tax on food, so the government said to Truffle Hunt as well, how about 3%? And they said, no. My father hasn't paid. My grandfather hasn't paid. My great-grandfather hasn't paid. I'm not going to pay. So, but I think it's also cultural. They love the idea of doing things in the shadow of a church at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
It's part of their shtick, which is cool. Although I wouldn't want my grandfather out dealing truffles at 4 in the morning.
No. What can folks do? You know, like, if you've got one of these great kind of local tracks, aside from spectating, going and spectating, or even better, you know, building a race car and yeah. showing up.
Gotcha.
You know, what do people actually do about the vanishing, you know, local businesses and local racetracks and...
Well, I think it's good. If you do have a mom and pop in your town, you should support the mom and pop. Obviously, it's better to support your local bakery than buying your bread from Walmart. Because what
it'll probably
happens
taste
is,
better too.
It'll taste better. There's love in the bread instead of it made in some factory middle of nowhere. But that's part of the issue is that once you, like in this town of Riverhead, most of the town is going to work for Walmart now. And Walmart, of course, pays, you know, not a living wage.
Yeah.
And no health benefits. And then they give you a little discount, 15% or something to buy your food there. So in essence, just live
in Walmart. Was just docked here in yeah. Marina Del Rey. Yeah. Well, 290 feet registered in the Caymans.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the three bitches, bullshit. The three richest women in the world.
Yeah.
Is the Walton sisters, but just can't find their way to pay, give health insurance to their employees.
It's very depressing.
It shouldn't be allowed.
How long do you think this racetrack's got left?
Oh, I think once the film comes out and it becomes, hopefully, you know, more famous than it is, it'll stay around for years.
Do you think this racetrack is, I mean, aside from being the last one on Long Island, I mean, do you think... This is a not a metaphor, but like, you know, do you think this the situation and the characters and the people behind this racetrack, do you think this could have been any
oh, yeah.
small oval?
Oh, yeah. Well, it could have been any small town. Any yeah. town that's being annihilated from development from big box stores. I think this is the story. I mean, it's not only it's really about necessarily a racetrack, but it's about towns that are just under assault. And what value it is to have places like this exist. You know, it's no different than your local bakery. I mean, the bakery, the diner, you know, wherever you'd sit and communicate with people about mm-hmm. what's new, what's happening in the town, those things are all being eliminated by having just chains and box stores in your town. That's just not a good thing.
I know.
We see it in Europe, too. I mean, we see it. We're working now in Italy. It's a similar story. I mean, where we're working now in Italy, they're deforesting. They're taking all the trees down. And they're replacing it with vines, with grapevines, because it's more profitable. But what you do
to make all of Italy a vineyard,
yeah,
pretty much.
Pretty much is where we are. And but
see,
that is no
like,
birds.
I like Italian wine a lot. Italian wine's good.
But is this 15 million
gonna
bottles
be like,
a year is enough?
But yeah. is this going to be like shitty commercial grade Italian wine and not the
no,
Italian wine that we know
good.
And love? Is it?
Well, it's pretty good wine. But the thing is, then you've limited
what they're doing over there.
We'll keep the truffles. We just we have enough. There's plenty of wine, but
yeah.
The problem is now there's no bees left. No bees. No birds.
Oh yeah, the bees. Yeah,
yeah
our honey.
Wine,
honey is going to be a real
tons
problem.
Tons of pesticides. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
we're running out of honey. Isn't that a thing? Are we running out of honey?
We're running out of bees. Yeah. Bees and honey. And the film you see in the last race, the guy explains about how bees work. You know, Tim Mulqueen explains. Well, you'll have to see, but he explains why.
Is he a beekeeper?
Well, he has a garden. He has a soft side. Not only is he a race car driver, a really aggressive one, he has a soft side where he grows berries in his garden. And he gives you a lesson why you need bees in your garden. Otherwise, you just don't have berries.
Well, don't they pollinate everything and keep things going?
That's what
it
is.
That's a thing, right?
It's a lesson about pollination from Tim Mulqueen, race car driver.
Car 77.
You know who I respect? Just, you know, as this trailer cycles in your, in the background here, the corner workers, like track workers, and
great.
You know, a lot of these guys, they trade labor for track mm-hmm. time, and some yeah. of them just do it out of the goodness of their heart. It's amazing to me that these guys will just sit out in that little tower.
I think
all
everybody
day.
Has a volunteer. Almost everybody I know at that racetrack is a volunteer. The guys, the cleanup crew. Captain Video, of course.
No, he charges $1. No, that is a capitalist.
That's true. That's true. He can sell 5 DVDs a week. You're right. That's pretty good. No, but most of the people are here because they, you know, it's attached to identity. They identify with being at this racetrack. I'm sure a lot of them think they're racers. A lot of them think they're going to make the big leagues. Even they're a maintenance guy. You know? But it's true. One of the guys, this guy, CJ. It's his father and son. His father is the maintenance guy. He sweeps up whenever there's an accident. And what he does, he just, you know, he's every cent he can scrape up, he puts into his son's race car because he wants his son to race. It's not a great race car. It's getting there.
Yeah.
It's been 3 years. It's getting there. But he's, you know, picks up a carburetor, but it's not a, you know.
The McLaren Scout yeah. is not there, you know.
Not yet.
Is there a Ray yeah. Hall Letterman, you know, racing
well,
member?
There is a guy named Ryan Preece who just made the bigs. He's on, he just got picked up by Hendrix. So he's He's racing in the bigs now. Ryan Preece, Preece. He's now just got a ride.
Really?
Modified. He's a big
see
guy
what he's
now.
Doing here. Ryan Preece. Oh, here he is.
Look at him. This is a Riverhead kid.
This is a Riverhead guy, huh? Riverhead.
Look at him. Look what he got. Hendrix, right?
Yeah. Look at this. American professional stock car racing driver competes in the NASCAR Wayland Modified Tour, driving the number 6 Chevrolet for T.S. Haulers Racing and part-time in the Xfinity Series for Joe Gibbs Racing.
That's right. Gibbs there just picked go. Him up, gave him a ride, and now he's in the bigs.
Look at this. No, on this past Saturday, he finished 5th.
Yep.
Good for this guy. How about Ryan. How about that?
And he started at go-karting in Riverhead.
There you go.
Started at 7 years old.
I mean, that's Mario
Andretti
how they
started
start.
That, Mario Andretti raced at that racetrack.
That's how they all start.
Yep.
Oh, he's got a whole grocery store.
Yeah, he's the
aisle. He's got a Velveeta. He's got Kroger, Cheerios. He's got a whole breakfast, you know, thing happening. This dude, this is some Ricky Bobby shit right here. This guy, good for him. Good for you, Ryan. Respect, sir.
They don't have enough decals on their stickers on
that's
their.
A good looking race car.
Oh, yeah,
got a good looking race car. Although it's really weird.
Is there Cheerios on the back?
Yeah, you got Cheerios, Velveeta. If you combine all that shit into one, it'd be weird. It's really weird that they're doing the Camaro and Mustang front ends on the NASCAR now, because these proportions just don't look right.
Yeah, well, that's NASCAR for you. That's why I like street stocks myself.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is that your race?
I love street stocks because it's entry level. You know, anybody can do it. $500 in a junkyard, you got yourself a car.
Are you familiar with the 24 Hours of Lemons?
Yeah.
We do a lot of that out here.
Yeah, I know.
And
cool.
And I race in a series called American Endurance Racing.
Oh, really?
Which is it's like a half a bump up from that. It's not in Lemons the cars are like a joke.
Yeah.
You know, they theme them like a chicken or a fucking upside down speedboat or some shit. You know, they make him real ridiculous. In the one I race in AER, the cars are still pretty cheap, but they are supposed to look normal.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
So when are you doing that next?
I just did a race in Ohio last month. Did not go well. We didn't crash, but it didn't. We broke a bunch of shit. It didn't go well. But it's
that's cool.
You know, but I do think for the trouble. You know, obviously what your point in your film is about the small business being killed off by the big business and that kind of stuff. On the other hand, cheap racing in general, especially if you're into road courses, it's never been a better time to go cheap racing than right now. There's between Chump Car, with you familiar with
Chump Car? Yeah.
You know, they just bought the rights to Champ Car.
Really?
The actual Chump Car is now actually called Champ Car.
Wow.
And
that's cool. That's great.
And you know, you Lemons Champ Car. There's another one called Lucky Dog. There's WRL World Racing League. There's another one I can't remember, but there's a few. There's a few options. Yeah, if you want to do cheap racing now,
that's good.
There are affordable ways.
Great.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, because NASCAR Cup racing, you gotta have some.
Oh yeah, I mean anything that's quote professional is super super huge dollars.
Yeah,
but
those cars
and even like fuck the cheap racing is kind of expensive still. I mean,
well, tires are a lot of money.
Yeah, even tires for a Miata. You know, or it can be $1,000
a
weekend.
$1,000.
I did notice that for all the shittiness of these guys' cars, they do seem to run
Hoosier
real
tires.
They run Hoosiers. Yeah, they run.
Yeah, it costs them $750 a weekend.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
This thing is, these cars are really like a cage and good tires and pretty much nothing else.
That's pretty much
it. Yeah,
pretty much it.
Pretty much
and sneakers.
It.
That's it.
So the movie comes out November 16th. In theaters and on demand. You said 100 theaters? Is that what you said?
Well, 100 theaters tomorrow night is a sneak preview.
Oh, man, that's rad.
Tomorrow night.
Where does it happen in L.A.?
I think, I don't know where, but you have to look at thelastracethefilm.com.
It's the last race. Oh, here we go. Special screenings. I'll pull it up.
Yeah, that's it.
Thelastracethefilm.com.
There it is. See?
And, oh, here we go.
There you go.
Where are we there?
Edwards. Yeah, there it is.
Irvine Spectrum. Oh, we've somehow ended up in Orange County. Anything in L.A.? Oh, no.
No, well you got to wait for Friday night.
All right. But look, if I zoom out, will there be all over?
No, Ocean County. Well,
how far? Oh, yeah, here we go.
There you go. Well,
most places that have, if you're in a blue state, you're in good luck. In the red states, maybe not so much. But, yeah.
I don't know how that happened.
Certainly in New York, North Carolina, Tennessee. Yeah, I mean, your major cities. All your major cities. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And then on demand, what, iTunes?
iTunes, Amazon, Music? A whole bunch of places.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I really like the poster with this smoldering Monte Carlo.
Yeah, I took that picture and that's really
it's
what
a
it
good
was.
Picture.
Yeah,
I like that.
That's the way it is.
Can you get me a movie poster? I'd love to rock a movie poster of that. That's a dope one.
We'll
put it up next to our Senna poster here.
Senna's a great film.
Have you seen Senna? We had Asif on the show and
many times.
God, that movie rules. Do you have any other racing documentaries that you're into?
Not docs. Well, I like, I guess I like Le Mans. It's not a racing doc. I like Le Mans. Grand Prix.
Almost.
Grand Prix, I think, is a really beautiful film.
Yeah.
Where it's shot. I mean, it's kind of cheesy, but it's shot beautifully. And then Days of Thunder, believe it or not, I studied that to see how it was shot.
Days of Thunder rules.
They shot that. I don't know how, but it's
there's a couple movies. Anytime they're on television, I'm stopping.
Days of Thunder, you have to watch it all the time.
Any Back to the Future film,
great.
Stopping.
Yeah, yeah.
Days of Thunder, stopping.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No. And here, one of my favorite ones I just always like to drop is a movie just called One.
What is that
film? It's just the number one. It's a documentary from 2013. And here, I'll just pull up the IMDb page. It's a fantastic. Uh oh, we have an ad.
Oh, look out! It's coming
at
you. Robot.
We've got an ad.
Transformer.
I don't know what happened here, but this is it. It's just the number one, and it's about the evolution of
Formula One
safety in Formula One racing. But it's really fast paced, really exciting.
Check it out.
It's narrated by Michael Fassbender. Does a really really good job.
That's cool.
And this is one of my favorite racing docs to watch. I've got it on my computer. I probably watched it 100 times.
I'll check it out.
That's a really good one. It's if you like Senna, then you'll definitely like One also.
Senna's
but not
story.
To take away from your documentary, The Last Race is in theaters the 16th. Michael Dweck, thank you very much for joining. Oh,
thanks.
Come on.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me, man. I appreciate it. Anything else you want to plug before we get out of here?
No. What else? No, that's it. Just come see the movie and say nice things.
Hopefully, I'm gonna get it on demand. I'm gonna have a look at it too. I like the trailer. Looked great, and I can't wait to watch it.
Well, thanks, man.
Thanks for coming on the show. The Smoking Tire Podcast is powered by Shout Engine. Get your own damn podcast at shoutengine.com. It's easy. All you need is a microphone, a connection to the internet, and preferably something to say. Thank you very much. See you guys later. Bye.
Thanks.